You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is another bonus episode. Welcome back, everybody. Earlier this month, Professor John Agar gave a lecture here at UCL about the history of artificial intelligence research in the UK. His lecture starts with a surprising answer. In the 1970s, James Lighthill compiled a report to government in which he argued research into artificial intelligence should be stopped. This had a massive effect on government policy and funding. It likely caused what's known as the first AI winter. Why is this a surprising answer? Well, partly it's because Lighthill was an expert in the subject. You might predict he'd champion AI. And partly, too, he was a big player in UK science and technology policy. He'd soon become provost. That's the top job at University College London. You might predict he'd see great financial benefits and great prestige by supporting more work in this area. But in this lecture, John tells the story of Lighthill and his report. John's gone through the archives, and he's studied what people said at the time. His results show how history can be surprising. He also shows how history can give us new perspectives on problems we deal with today. Lighthill's report is nearly 50 years old, but John connects it with issues hot on the table today. We pick up John's talk after he's been introduced. He's speaking over a Zoom connection, so John, take it away.
So I am co-head of Department of Science and Technology Studies with Emma Tobin, STS. Let me say a little bit about STS to start with. STS is a useful subject. We seek to understand two of the greatest forces in the modern world, science and technology, using not just one disciplinary perspective, but applying the techniques of history, sociology, political science, and philosophy. Why is STS needed? Well, we've spent the last year being told that it is necessary to follow the science. But if we know anything, it's surely that to make wise decisions, we need to understand not just the science of viruses or the technology of vaccines, but also how science-based decisions are made, how science relates to government, and how the sheer diversity of society responds to scientific communication. We might be in a better place if our political masters had studied STS at UCL rather than PPE at Oxford. Now, I said that STS is a useful subject, and for my mind, there's no better preparation for understanding and changing the world, what a UCL education aims for, than STS. Let me tell you about an experimental course that's been running for 2 years now. It's called STS Perspectives on Big Problems. Each summer, we poll our third-year students and staff about what they think is the biggest problem facing us all. Then, when our new first years arrive, they take that course and learn how STS can help us think through those problems. And this year, they chose artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence today, well, if we look at the headlines, we see things like this. We're perhaps at the crest of a wave of excitement over AI, especially around the application of machine learning. And it generates extraordinary headlines and attracts funding. But alongside the positive headlines and the money, there are anxieties and fears. Now, we know in SDS that this combination of high expectations and worries is not an unusual feature of the media coverage of emerging technologies. But the field of artificial intelligence research is distinctive in one way. AI research is unusually prone to wild peaks and troughs of excitement and funding. The years when things go well are known as AI summers. The tough times, when the money dries up and research is hard, are called AI winters. We can see that there was a first AI summer from the 1950s to the 1970s, and then a second in the 1980s. And now we're in the third hottest summer of AI research. But precisely because we know that AI is prone to giant swings up and down, shouldn't we seek to know why they happen? Now, I'm a historian. I'm a historian of modern science and technology. And I think here's where historical methods can help. Because when archives are available, we can reach behind what was publicly known at the time and find deeper causes of change. And I'm going to tell you a story based on historical research in the archives held in UCL's special collections. Because one of the causes of the first AI winter was a critical report written in 1972 by James Lighthill, an outstanding mathematician who later became provost of UCL. Now, here's how the entrepreneur and AI practitioner Daniel Crevier summarized the situation in his 1993 book, AI, The Tumultuous History of the Search for Artificial Intelligence. American researchers were not the only ones to feel the ebbing of the tide. A scathing report to their government on the state of AI research devastated their British colleagues. Its author, Sir James Lighthill, had distinguished himself in fluid dynamics and had occupied Cambridge University's Lucasian Chair of Mathematics, held afterwards by Stephen Hawking. Lighthill pointed out to the Science Research Council of the UK that AI's grandiose objectives remained largely unmet, and as a result, his report called for a virtual halt to all AI research in Britain. Now, in some ways, that's the familiar account. AI is charged with overpromising, making grand predictions about its progress that were not fulfilled. And while Lighthill's report did indeed cause AI research to stall, and his report was a factor in this worldwide phenomenon, I suggest that Lighthill's critique, or rather his principled motivation of it, has been misunderstood. And I'm going to show the archive evidence from UCL's special collections that proves it. So here's the plan for today. I'm going to tell the story in five stages. First, I'm going to offer a quick overview of the history of AI. Second, I'm going to introduce our protagonist properly. Who exactly was James Lighthill? Third, I'm going to trace the argument of the Lighthill report and why it was so devastating for AI research. Fourth, I'm going to look at the responses from AI researchers at the time. And finally, and it will become obvious, I hope, why, I'm going to reflect on what the story tells us about today's choices in science policy and industrial strategy. So, first, the short history of AI. Well, there are two versions of the history of artificial intelligence, a long version and a short version. The long version reaches way back. It might start with stories and myths of moving mechanical statues in ancient Greece, or this one, a brazen head, a head made of bronze that was supposedly made by the medieval scholar Roger Bacon, a mechanical head that could talk. The long history would place today's attempts to make machines that do intelligent things in a long line of very real projects to build automata. These Enlightenment machines were often beautiful triumphs of artisanal skill, luxury objects paid for by patrons to provoke reflection and awe. Automatons such as this famous Silver Swan, built by the artisan John Joseph Merlin in 1773, the swan moves and appears to search and choose tiny, delicious fish to eat. You can still see it in operation at the Bowes Museum in Barnard Castle. It's still the only valid reason to travel to Barnard Castle. Automata blurred the line between the living and the non-living. They lived in the uncanny valley. They troubled spectators by performing and doing things that surely only the living or even human could do. But these things were various, playing music, speaking and singing, moving limbs with purpose, or even, in the case of one of my favourites, Jacques Vaucanson's duck, not only eating, but excreting too. Now, it was only in the 20th century that what was seen as distinctively human was intelligent cognition. And this is where we find the short history of AI. Now, at mid-century, the intensity and speed of global conflict had created the need for fast electronic manipulation of symbols and data. The result was the first stored program computers, giant machines full of thousands of electronic valves. We see here one of the first, a Ferranti Mark I, built in Manchester. On the right, you can see Alan Turing. Now, when this photograph was taken, Alan Turing had just published a paper in the philosophy journal Mind. Called Computing Machinery and Intelligence, Turing asked what it would mean to answer the question, can machines think? Now, we all know about one part of his answer, the imitation game, the so-called Turing test. But much of the paper is Turing's rebuttal of all the possible objections to the idea of thinking machines. Turing wrote, I believe that at the end of the century, the use of words and general educated opinion will have altered so much that one will be able to speak of machines thinking without expecting to be contradicted. It was an idea and a bold prediction, but scientific ideas remain just that without funding. The first warm summer of artificial intelligence research would not have happened without the Cold War. The Cold War pumped money, mostly American defense dollars, into fast computing. I love this cover of Time magazine from 1950, the same year as Turing's Mind paper and the year of the start of the conflict in Korea. It shows a mainframe computer, but it has an eye. And that eye is examining its own paper tape data output. It is self-reflective, clearly intelligent. The strap line asks, can man build a Superman? But it's also, notice, wearing a uniform, the uniform of a US admiral. It's a military machine, a Cold War intelligent automaton. American scientists, mathematicians, and cyberneticians in the early Cold War crystallized the field of artificial intelligence. The term itself was coined in preparation for a conference at Dartmouth College on the East Coast in 1956. As the proposal, written in 1955, stated, the study is to proceed on the basis of the conjecture that every aspect of learning or any other feature of intelligence can in principle be so precisely described that a machine can be made to simulate it. And it's from this group that we not only get the name artificial intelligence, but also a host of bold claims and predictions, ones that went beyond Turing. And following the Cold War shock of Sputnik in 1957, the funding faucets were open full. Soon, another imitation game was in play. Scientists in other countries, including Britain, expanded artificial intelligence research. Through the 1950s, 1960s, and into the 1970s, AI was booming. Now's a good time to turn to James Lighthill. Who was James Lighthill? Well, here's James Lighthill. Older viewers, listeners might be reminded, like me, of the British comedian Ronnie Barker. Actually, both these pictures are of James Lighthill. Michael James Lighthill was born in 1924 and he won a scholarship to Trinity College, Cambridge at age 15. During the Second World War, he worked at the National Physical Laboratory on supersonic and hypersonic aerodynamics. Afterwards, he taught mathematics at Manchester University, where he ran one of the most powerful and inventive fluid dynamics groups ever formed anywhere. In 1959, he was appointed director of the Royal Aircraft Establishment, RAE Farnborough. His work on supersonic wing shape was used in the design of Concorde. In 1964, he returned to academia as a Royal Society professor at Imperial College before moving to Cambridge as Lucasian Professor of Mathematics in 1969, succeeding Paul Dirac. So he comes between Paul Dirac and Stephen Hawking, which gives us some sense of his stature as a mathematician. From 1979, he was provost of UCL, University College London, where he remained for a decade. At UCL, he stressed the need for universities to produce graduates in useful subjects, such as building. In fact, the modern Bartlett building is a testament to that. In 1998, Lighthill died while swimming around the island of Sark, a feat he had completed four times previously. In terms of his mathematics, Lighthill specialised in fluid dynamics, but in a distinctive way. Many of his best papers started in one practical context, but found application in a wide variety of others. A 1952 paper on jet engine noise was applied to understanding the sun's corona. A 1956 paper on nonlinear acoustics was used in contexts as various as kidney stone therapies, flood waves in rivers, traffic flow on highways. His biofluid dynamics spanned blood flow, breathing, bird flight, and how fish swim. And the UCL special collections are full of drawings of diagrams of fish swimming and birds flying. In 1966, Lighthill was invited onto a working party reviewing UK nuclear fusion research, leading this work at Culham. Fusion was classic Cold War big science. It was immensely expensive. It made bold promises and false starts. Lighthill viewed the working party's report as half-hearted. With one other, he broke ranks and issued a minority report. He argued no work on the production of power through fusion reactors was justifiable. He suggested that Culham's hundreds of staff might be better redirected to efforts to raise the efficiency of British industry by intensively surveying and working on the direct technological problems of business. And the willingness to strike boldly and independently was surely noted within government circles. It was almost certainly why he was chosen to write his report on AI. Now, what I'm showing you here is a letter I found in the UCL Special Collections, and I'm just going to read a portion of it. In September 1971, the chair of the Science Research Council, Brian Flowers, wrote to Lighthill. He writes, There are few subjects which at any particular time strike one as having a very special potential for being pervasively important. But artificial intelligence seems to me to be such a field. Overlapping as it does with neurobiology, psychology, linguistics, and computer-aided learning, not to mention mathematics and computer science proper. These subjects, says Flowers, and artificial intelligence itself are highly complex, very much the preserve of experts, and perhaps sometimes of plausible charlatans. It is getting increasingly difficult for the Research Council to control this mix of activities and make properly informed judgments. Now, I consider this letter, found in UCL Special Collections in the Lytle archives there, to be a remarkable and unusual steer. Flowers asked Lighthill to review the field of artificial intelligence. Initially reluctant, by late 1971 and early 1972, he was very busy investigating the state of AI research in the UK. He wrote letters to active researchers and he consulted wider views. He visited teams, notably the ones in Edinburgh. He submitted his report in March 1972. Quite frankly, Lighthill told Flowers, I'm fully aware when my report becomes widely available, I shall be involved in a great deal of controversy. So why did this former UCL professor think that research in AI should be stopped? There's a specific argument in the report, but there's also a deeper explanation that I have found evidence for in the Lighthill archives. Lighthill's specific argument was as follows. Lighthill divided up the subject of AI into three categories, A, B, and C. A, he called advanced automation. It was work to replace intelligent human beings by machines for specific purposes. Examples might include control engineering or automating office work or code breaking or missile guidance. C concerned what Lighthill called computer-based central nervous system research. Modelling neurobiological and psychological activities such as pattern recognition, memory, language use, and the acquisition of knowledge. It's like an AI of the brain and mind. A and C linked to established scientific and engineering disciplines. And in the middle was B. B stood for building robots. But under B was a broad class of general intelligence activities, playing games, visual scene analysis, common sense, coordination of eye and hand. B was also supposedly a bridge. It borrowed from A and B, and it sought to influence them. But B was the problem, said Lighthill. Its aims and objectives were hard to discern. It was distant from applications and established disciplines. And only the existence of the category B, argued Lighthill, created AI's claim for unity and coherence. And he reported, I quote, a widespread feeling that progress in the bridge category B has been disappointing, both as regards the work actually done and as regards the establishment of good reasons for doing such work and thus creating any unified discipline. So the story of inflated predictions came from failures of work in category B. B was a failed bridge. AI, artificial intelligence, was not and could not be unified, argued Lighthill. Governments should fund A and C through traditional disciplines, but not B. He threw fuel onto the fire in the report as well, by adding speculations about why B might have grown at all. Perhaps scientists were pandering to the public and the public's penchant for robots. Perhaps, asked Lighthill, and I quote, the stimulus of laborious male activity is the urge to compensate for lack of female capability of giving birth to children. Total speculations. Lighthill's famous report was published in a deeply unusual format. In 1972, the Science Research Council published it as part of a paper symposium. Included were the Lighthill report and four responses. One was in support and three were critical. The most critical came from, and with the man with most at stake, came from Donald Mickey. Now, Mickey is a fascinating figure. He'd been a teenager when he started working with Turing at Bletchley Park. He was fascinated by the idea of intelligent machines. In the 1950s, finding no employment in that field, he'd worked at UCL with his then wife, the equally interesting Anne McLaren, in animal genetics. He was appointed reader in the Department of Surgical Science in Edinburgh in 1958, but a trip to the States in 1962 opened his eyes to AI developments there. And back in the UK, he lobbied for better computer facilities and remarkably set up his own unofficial unit, which eventually became a Department of Machine Intelligence and Perception. Mickey cultivated AI contacts with researchers from the US and indeed the Soviet Union. And the breadth of this research in Edinburgh can be seen by this imaginary grand exhibition of AI, a proposal written in 1972 and sent to Lighthill. It includes programs which can rapidly acquire skill in any of a wide range of games on being told the rules, programs able to compose interesting music or poetry or graphic art, programs able to control a driverless vehicle to navigate an unknown terrain, programs able to prove mathematical theorems de novo, i.e. from scratch, perhaps not the wisest boast to make to a mathematician, programs able to recognize speech, understand stories, make scientific hypotheses given data, programs to use robotic hand-eye devices. Now, much of that was Category B work, the work Lighthill wanted ended. The work of the Research Council, acting on Lighthill's advice, cut funding for. And with his rapidly expanding research and bold predictions, one might wonder if Mickey had been the Research Council's target all along. So the Lighthill report does seem to be a critical assault on the coherence of the field of artificial intelligence. But I want to suggest a deeper cause. Evidence gleaned from Lighthill's papers in UCL Special Collections enable us to uncover a deeper reason for Lighthill's arguments against AI. And in his papers and correspondence, in which he expressed deeper convictions and principles, what becomes apparent is Lighthill's commitment to a particular view about how the best science is done. It's a good question, isn't it? Under what conditions, what arrangements, is the best science produced? A clue can be found in the text of the Lighthill report itself, in which he says again and again that the problem is lack of engagement with immediate fields of application. And in the Lighthill archive, we can find empirical evidence for the strength of a conviction about what we might call good science policy. His best and most influential fluid dynamics papers started in problems and ended in problems. The critique of fusion research was an argument for redeployment of skills towards immediate problem solving. At Farnborough, he'd made speeches to the scientists arguing against the ivory tower and stating that science of the highest merit came from science done under the, quote, boundary condition, lovely mathematical way of thinking about it, of application to the world's problems. In 1962, he'd set up a new society, the Institute for Mathematics and its Applications, headquarters very near here, born out of frustration with the pure orientation of mathematics in established institutions. In the Lighthill report itself, categories A and C were solid because they were oriented towards fields of applications, and he said so directly. When he was provost at UCL, he supported the research that stressed application to the problems of the world around us. good provost tradition. In the 1980s, when consulted again by the government, he welcomed the new industrial strategy of funding intelligent, knowledge-based systems research under the ALVI programme because of a direct link of research to practical needs. So he welcomed the second AI summer. Now, some of the primary sources I've been looking at are quite hard to figure out. This is some of his sketches for what his Institute of Mathematics and its applications might be like. And I haven't got to the bottom of all those symbols yet. But the overall pattern, I think, is quite clear, that Lighthill's convictions about the conditions for the best science became, for him, a guiding principle. Running through Lighthill's career is this principle that the very best scientific work comes from a tight relationship between research and practical problem solving. We might call this orientation to problem solving a grand challenge approach. If so, then it is testament to a distinctive UCL tradition. The Lighthill report on artificial intelligence was not an attack on AI, but a review of AI guided by this principle. For Lighthill, scientific work of the highest merit was framed by practical problem solving, within which scientific excellence was pursued and achieved. The problems might be offered by industry, commerce, government, or society more broadly. So I'm going to move to some sort of bring it up to date, some conclusions and some final thoughts. So moving to conclusion, some reflections about artificial intelligence then and now, and what are today's choices. So I've shown you, I hope, why a former UCL provost thought that research in AI should be stopped. He thought that it did not connect clearly enough with the world's problems, as well as being incoherent as a result. But so what? Why be interested in James Lighthill? Why be interested in his report, which is now nearly half a century old? Well, we are now in AI's third hottest summer. AI has always had the wild peaks and troughs, high expectations, and only some fulfilled. And there's no harm in asking why past summers have ended. Now, I've been reading Dame Wendy Hall and Jerome Pezzenti's recent report to government on growing the AI industry in the UK. It's perhaps the recent analogue to the Lighthill report. So this came out, I think, over this year or the year before. It's a review of AI that makes recommendations to government, just like Lighthill's report. But it differs. It's immensely positive. And it's part of a framing now. AI is regarded as strategically essential to the British economy. It is one of the four grand challenges of the industrial strategy. And that's what you see in this other image. So artificial intelligence and data, alongside aging society, clean growth, and the future of mobility, are four grand challenges being set as strategic aims for research funded by UKRI. Now, the authors of Growing the Artificial Intelligence Industry in the UK, Wendy Hall and Jerome Pezzenti, well, Hall is a deeply respected academic computer scientist with roots in industry. Pezzenti is VP of AI at Facebook. The funding figures they quote are startling, even if they are to be taken with perhaps a pinch of salt. The US government spending $1.2 billion in, quote, unclassified R&D for AI in 2016, for example, but compare that to McKinsey's estimate of big tech firms investing between $20 and $30 billion in the same period. There's now an ecosystem with big tech firms and research at universities intertwined. But it's no longer a case of big companies buying the spin-offs, but of a much further reach. And I quote again from Hall and Pazenti, leading players are not just hiring from universities, they're hiring the universities. Amazon, Google, and Microsoft have moved to funding professorships and directly acquiring university researchers in the search for competitive advantage. There's a huge demand for skills. And it may be a research ecosystem, but there's no doubt what the keystone species are and who is at the top of the food chain. So one big difference between AI then and now is the role of big tech. Google, Facebook, Amazon, and so on. And they have very deep pockets. The summer they are funding may feel like an endless one. But perhaps seasons, winters and summers, are a bad metaphor. There's no natural, inevitable turning of the earth here, but rather choices are made. Choices that affect research, choices of what to fund and what problems to solve. So I want to end with a contrast and a question. First, the contrast, and it concerns accountability. Lighthill, an independent scientist, was asked by a research council, a public body, to review the field of AI. The research council then made decisions based on advice. But decisions of the research council were accountable. They would be accountable through the internal processes of peer review. They were, in principle, accountable through the external processes of Parliament, as public money pickers could be questioned. A minister could be asked in Parliament, an advisor pressed by select committee, we could ask our MP. The AI of the third summer is not accountable in this way. Much as we would want to know the decision-making processes of big tech and therefore of the AI around us are inaccessible, we don't know, and unaccountable, we can't seek redress or explanation by right. Now, Lightor might have been right or wrong, but the decisions he influenced were democratically within our hands, in principle. And this contrast between then and now leads to a final observation and a question. My final observation is that AI research today is intensely problem-oriented. You could cite many examples from Hall and Pazenti's advice to government. You've only got to look through the descriptions of startup companies, the news on venture capital investments, and each one is linked to problems of various kinds. AI for health, AI for self-driving cars, AI for sustainable development goals, AI for giving social media users a better, more bespoke, more personal service for ads. So this is indeed an orientation towards problem solving. Lighthill would be happy. But there is something missing. Something that Lighthill didn't ask about, despite his lifelong commitment to research orientation towards problems. Who chooses the problems? And what democratic route do we have to shape those choices? Thank you very much. I'm going to say thank you. Thank you to Matt and Sana. And particularly Eleanor for introducing me. Thank you for listening. Come and study with us if you want to hear about problems and how to solve them in a broad context of science and technology in society. Come and join us at STS. And I'd like to say a special thanks for access to the Lighthill papers. History only works if we can get access to archives, to UCL special collections for keeping them and showing them so well. So thank you very much.
Hey, you made it. Well done. That's another bonus episode, Tick. Thanks to John for allowing us to excerpt his lecture. Also, thanks to John for giving his lecture in the first place. If you want to see his presentation, or if you want to explore any of the other great talks in the UCL Mind series, head over to their YouTube channel or their website for more. Links are in the show notes. But I gotta warn you, there's a lot, and watching can get addictive. Remember, just pace yourself. Music today was the song Rollin' at Five by Kevin MacLeod. It's available on the website filmmusic.io. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you're keen to explore more history of technology, the ethics of AI, or any of the other great topics in STS, just get in touch. We're happy to talk. We'll have another episode in a week's time. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss out. Finally, you can find out more about the show, tell us what you think, and explore more about the courses we offer in the Department of Science and Technology Studies just by visiting our website. Here's the address, so write it down. It's ucl.ac.uk/sts/podcast. That's it for today. We'll meet here again soon. Till then, everybody, I'm Professor Joe Kane. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Follow us online at ucl.ac.uk/sts/podcast.